Alrighty. Looks like we're all here, right? Okay. Just to clarify, I'm a hurt is not a woman. Can be a guy or a lady. Just as hurt. This is the notice and demand that we had to make the best compromise with all the information that we have. Some of you are far more advanced. We've seen your faces. We know you know much more than others in this audience. And I personally have been in that position, and I want to thank you for your patience of putting up with the newcomers. This is a document that is the fourth document in the line of notice and demands. We suggest, like Bill said, that you have a first notice and demand, a second one, the third one, and this would be the fourth, would be the last stage before going to court. This encompasses both FDB and IRS possibilities with case law and citations, code, and everything else that would be supportive of the statutory aspects that if you do not feel, just one second, that you don't feel comfortable with, hopefully these will have some answers of why and where the statutory foundation is to challenge their claims. Yes, sir.
Are we going to get copies of this as well?
This will be, okay, that's a very good question at this point. This, we were thinking of putting this in a PDF format, but I kind of disagree with that because you would not have access to editing your own. And when I was downloading, if somebody put a Word document for me, I could take it, adapt, and make modifications rather than having to transfer it sometimes. The problem with that, we've learned, is the Word transfers differently on different computers. So we don't know what the best format to put it on. So what we're going to do, we're going to put it as a PDF and a Word. Because in Word, you can do this trick here. If we have it, it will be this very document we're going to address here will be on 1215.org. And if you have it in Word, you can do that.
Yeah. Right.
Can everybody see that?
Right, exactly.
And you can reference it, and you can take, paste, and copy, do whatever you please with it.
Can you embellish it?
Make it easy. You embellish whatever you choose to do. It's going to be your choice. Just to so you know, we've worked on this document for past a little over 3 months.
Yeah.
It's been on 43 rewrites, and this is the 13th revision. All right, just so you know the insides of this. We put a lot of thought and a lot of what do we leave in, why do we leave it. And so I'm going to go over details with you on every particular line, and I would appreciate that when we do take the 5 minutes, okay, 7 minute breaks, let's keep it that way because it's a long document. Although it's been shrunk from 18 pages to 17, it's going to take the same amount of time, and we need to be out of here by 7, 8 o'clock so they have the time to give you the DVDs today. I'm a little bit more disciplined when it comes to that requirement of time. If you don't mind, I'd appreciate your cooperation. let's dive into this. This notice and demand, again, is the fourth in a stage of 1, 2, 3 notice and demands, and this is the one right before going to court. I suggested, since I was in your places a while back, that what would have helped me would have been to have a networking workshop environment where I get to bring my own document, have somebody look it over. Well, Bill doesn't do that. Nobody does that. And nobody should do that because this will end up being a battle where we ourselves have to fence the enemy if we want to consider them enemies. Hopefully they'll become allies. The problem is that we don't know where to take it, how do I fill in this line, all those little details. So the purpose of this notice and demand is to put it right in between the levels of this particular audience today. Some of you are more advanced, some of you are less. So how can we benefit all from it? Well, if we have this notice and demand addressed today, those who are advanced can use it right away. Those who know how to handle the court process will be able to use this as the starting their court process. Or some that are already in court, maybe they can find some useful cases in here to cite their own court cases. Those who are less advanced, they will see what they're looking forward to acquire for the administrative process to arrive at this fourth notice and demand. What I talked to Bill and said, maybe we should consider putting together workshops specific for let's say, notice and demand, first communication. Notice and demand, second communication. Yeah. Third communication. So people that we would need a minimum of, say, 15 people. We have that workshop. People bring their own. Hey, look, I got mine here. Okay, what do you have? What do you have? And that exchange, that learning classroom environment is be a show and tell forum workshop kind of environment that would help us all learn from each other's mistakes. The benefits behind that, obviously, would be that now you bring in something that you got a response, say, from Patrick, and you share it with the class, with everybody else. And by their response, your response, we have a means to arrive at the same situation that they have. When we discover something that they screwed up, they take it, they give it to their 500 attorneys, the attorneys look it up, and they come up with a solution, and boom, they kill that little venue. But that one person that found that has no means of giving the feedback to the rest of the people. What I would hope to is every one of you to become a teacher or a guide yourselves. So that is my ultimate purpose of what I would like to see this as part of a network. Some of you just want to do your own thing and go home, which is understandable. So let's hope you can you get to understand this and absorb all this information and follow the guides of the common law, because it is my personal belief at this point, unless somebody here can tell me, look, I'm successful every time with administrative process, I get results, and IRS leaves me alone, and FTB leaves me alone, and then please come here and tell us, show us how. Okay? No problem. This is not a personality issue here. So I'm a sharer, and I would like to lead by example at this point, and I would love to be able to get off here and somebody else take, you know, take the tables. This is not a comfortable position. This air conditioning beats on me. So I'm going to do my cool look here. All right. Let's get started. These people here are actual agents writing you letters. Some of you may, this is Southern California. Some of you may relate to these names, Patrick, Angie, Daniel, Ceylon. You receive love letters, we call these. Love letters, because these people have to want to, you know, they want to write to us all the time. Yeah, love letters. Okay. The way it's set up, real quickly here, is simple. Just do one thing, certified mail to number one, certified mail number here. Number two would be certified mail over there, and so forth, right? Notice and demand. To the above addressed parties and all other interested parties, see footnote 1. Please take notice, footnote 2, of the following. The reason we put see footnote 1 is because we don't want to presume that the agents know what that symbol means. Okay, so see footnote 1, they say, what's a foot? Oh, it's right there. Okay, good. All right, so the above addressed parties and all other interested parties. Why are we saying that? Because California Civil Code 2332 says, as against a principal, both principal and agent are deemed to have notice of whatever either has notice of and ought, in good faith, and the exercise of ordinary care and diligence to communicate to others. Okay. Most typically, you're going to see in other people's writings, which is just as valid, but we prefer it formulated this way, that notice to principal is notice to agent and vice versa, right? And please take notice, and we define notice. Knowledge of the facts, which would naturally lead an honest and prudent person to make inquiry, constitutes notice of everything which such inquiry pursued in good faith would disclose. And those are the cases right there that notice has been addressed. So we start from the premise that, look, we're not specialists in this thing, and we received your letters or your communication, and we want to do everything decent and be on the up and up, you know, all cards on the table. So please take notice of this. And then we inform them of our little experience. The first page here is a brief into what we're going to talk about. And the next 7 pages are going to be part of Bill's notice and demand step 1, which is This is what you're doing. You're stepping on my toes. Kind of get off my toes. I'm going to let you know how bad it hurts because of this. We're making them aware of the situation. And we're kind of educating them as well based on information that we have. Now, you should remember that this being the fourth in line, everything that's being said as factual here, all these are facts basically that happened. Oh, and by the way, this is a case. This is an actual case. I forgot to mention that. So everything that happened here is true. These are facts. And everything that says we've done so and so on such and date, that was part of what I was saying before, notice and demands, prior notice and demands. So this is a summarization of three other notices and demands prior to this fourth one. Okay? So like many people, I shied away from the complex tax codes. I was misled that everybody owes federal and state income taxes until I learned about IRS agents, attorneys, CPAs, and paralegals who discovered that the tax codes were misinterpreted. We're not saying we're wrong, are illegal, unlawful, unconstitutional. We're not making any such statements. We learned that they weren't being misinterpreted. We're here to clarify some issues. I used this information to correct the records with the tax agencies, trusting that the revenue agents would not deceive me. We looked up the definition of revenue agents in a 2027 U.S.C. 250.11/2005. Revenue agent is any duly authorized Commonwealth Internal Revenue Agent of the Department of Treasury of Puerto Rico. So a little question mark, you know, in our mind raises our awareness and say, well, okay, maybe we should keep that and ask them, how does that relate? Are they Department of the Treasury of Puerto Rico? Makes sense, right? To my dismay and ever-increasing suspicion, instead of cooperation, I received non-responsive or evasive replies. The revenue agents appear to indeed misapply the codes and exceed their jurisdiction. The cases referenced herein denounced compelled taxation, recognized the abolition of slavery, and reinforced the constitutionally ordained limitations of the legislative powers. Now, what are legislative powers? Well, there is a case right there. It says the people of the several states are absolutely and unconditionally sovereign within their respective territories. That's nice to know, right? We're making them aware of that. I found no constitutional authority empowering legislators to impose a fair share duty upon people's fundamental liberty to make a living or to regulate people's productivity by licensing their economic means for the purpose of mandatory withholding at their workplace. And we skipped that footnote 5 there, and that's important. We can skip it. It's right here. It is not necessary to challenge the proposition that, as a general rule, the state, having power to deny a privilege altogether, may grant it upon some condition as if it sees fit to impose. But the power of the state in that respect is not, and this is page 594 where this citation is coming out of, is not unlimited. And one of the limitations is that it may not impose conditions which require the relinquishment of constitutional rights. Okay? So right there we start the premise of this notice and demand that we are not talking about tax issues here. We're talking about them coming at us under some jurisdiction liability constitutional issues here. And we're making them aware in the very first page. This is what this letter is all about. I think Fred wants to ask.
Yeah, a point of clarification or of interest.
Sure.
26 U.S.C. is not positive law, so you have to go to the statutes at large for the real legal evidence of the law. And I have gone through all Larry Beecraft's and the late Leo Masters' research on the statutes at large from the beginning, and I will pay $10 million to anybody that can find in any of those statutes at large the word pay your fair share. It does not exist in the statutes at large at all.
That's why we addressed it as your fair share. It's non-existent and we're not aware of any. But see, what we're doing here, we're trying to the letter that you all have, I gave you the copies, That letter is highly presumptuous. They make it sound like, hey, we know you're a taxpayer. You owe your duty. You better pay up. And if not, all those penalties, you know, it's a little threatening. If you receive one of those, you're going to say, okay, there's no hope. Why bother? You know, pay up. What's the difference between that and a mafia operation, you know? Anyhow, so we're assuming that these guys are government people. Fine. That's what it says on their letterheads. That's how they want to present themselves. We don't know. We just want to find out at this point. And this is what the notice and demand is. So I left this over. If the state may compel the surrender of one constitutional right as a condition of its favor, it may, in like manner, compel a surrender of all. This is the judge saying, right? It is inconceivable that guarantees embedded in the Constitution of the United States may thus be manipulated out of existence. Isn't that, in effect, what that Bill of Rights, Taxpayer Bill of Rights, kind of sounds like? Okay. And guess what? That's a Supreme Court decision. Okay? And it's a 1926, the Tax Act, whatever, 1913, 1916, that area, 1926, is pretty close. I think they knew what they were talking about. Okay? So let's move forward. Throughout the years, yes, sorry about that. Throughout the years, funds were withheld from me by third parties and transmitted to the federal and state tax agencies. Said funds were mistaken as related to taxable income. I tried to correct the errors by using the agency forms. The state, FTB revenue agents, hereinafter agents, replied at some point that the form has been determined to be frivolous and demanded that I file a valid tax return. Okay. Some don't say that the form is frivolous, but in this particular case, we have that exhibit here, which we cannot share with you at this point in time. This would be shared if we do the workshops one-on-one, because those will not be filmed. Those will not be videotaped. Those would be, you know, for privacy reasons, would have to be homework, a minimum of 15 people. So, Exhibit X here was presented in this case, that they said the form has been determined to be frivolous. Some of you may receive, well, your claim is frivolous, and so on and so forth, but it's irrelevant because we're addressing the term frivolous and valid tax return. A claim or defense is frivolous if a proponent can present no rational argument based upon the evidence or law in support of that claim. That's definition out of Black's Law Dictionary. The design of the forms did not allow any opportunity for rational argument. I offered to make all the necessary changes, and we have the exhibit, saying, look, please, if there is anything I don't want to do, you know, let me know what you need to do, and I'll change it, I'll modify everything. If agents would provide the forms, which, according to agents, so we gave them that upper hand, according to you, would be considered valid for correcting records. Remember on your form, I made you circle that valid form on page 4, I believe. It's a valid, or one of the pages. You circled valid, and it's underlined on your form. Okay, that is why. There is a question.
As you go through that, can you scroll that up to the top of the page so we can see it back here?
Oh, yes, sure. Please let me know, because I have no reference to that. I can't look in both places.
So that's the bottom.
The
other top.
Oh, the other way.
This is LA area.
The bottom of the screen is filled with heads.
What are you calling
it? People's heads in front of us. Yeah.
Oh, you're not talking to me. I'm sorry.
Scroll down every time you get a paragraph.
Right. This is noisy here, so I have a hard time. If you don't talk in the microphone, I can't quite hear you. Now I understand. Scroll up. Okay. That's good? All right. All right. So then we say the design of the forms did not allow any opportunity for rational argument. I offered to make all necessary changes.
Scroll down.
Oh, okay.
Raise it to the top of the page.
Yeah, if you're reading, put it on the top of the screen. What does that
mean? Thank you. Now that says it. Thank you. I understand. Agents dishonored my offer by providing no responsive answers, no valid return forms, no liability statute, and no proof of any alleged claim. I found agents' evasive maneuvers to be highly suspect and excuse me, and uncharacteristic of public servants. Okay, well, We have to be civil here, right? We're not going to assume anything, okay? We don't start with any presumptions that these are bad guys. These are good people. And actually, this is an appeal to the good people agents in this audience and the good people agents in the organizations. This is an appeal for them to understand where we're coming from. We don't want to change the government here. We want just the government to operate right as it was supposed to. All right. We don't want them to trespass in the territory of unlawfulness. 5 U.S.C. 556D, for those of you that don't know what that 5 U.S.C. means, that's 5 United States Code. That's the code for what government goes by. Except as otherwise provided by statute, the proponent of a rule or order has the burden of proof. And this particularly applies to government. So they sent no proof of any alleged claim. I found agents' evasive maneuvers to be highly suspect and uncharacteristic of public servants. Now, remember this, we addressed it, it's responsive. What would constitute a responsive answer? Let me give you an example of what happened here. We sent the letter asking, look, please, we believe you sent this communication in error, and I will do all the corrections necessary. Just be a little bit more specific so we know what it is you're doing, what you're asking for. And if you do not, then we're going to consider that this document is basically sent to us in error. There was no response. The original notice was signed by somebody. That person is like evaporated after this communication. Disappeared. A cycle of unsigned, unverified, computer-generated letters started pouring in. That is the honor and dishonor issues here, non-responsive. We consider that non-responsive because we followed up on that communication, right? That's a non-responsive answer. Agents ignored my demands for clarification and my offers to meet and settle the issues. And that's an exhibit. This exhibit, actually, is the equivalent of a default, where we wrote back to that person that originally wrote to us. And we wrote specific language and said, on such and such date we did this. Now you did not respond. I don't want to leave it to chance. I'm not going to choice it. Please make sure you respond or else, you know, you're going to be in default. And that's not going to look good with a judge. So agents ignored my demands, ignored judicial precedent, and continued their extra legal enforcement. That's self-explanatory. I don't need to go over that, right? Under the guise of policy, and we put a nice footnote there, policy never becomes law, no matter how well used or well accepted. Policy never gains legal authority by usage. Okay? Yes. You will have this. You'll have all this. I would... I used to take notes, and then I gave it up because I get to see DVDs and whatever. I get to watch it. A brewski on the side. I believe agents trespassed on my rights by violating their contract to public office as follows. So this is our statement. It's very short, sweet, doesn't go into big details, just gives them a relative position where we think that we are, where we think they are. And I need to attack this contract and public office because these are two, I call these powerful jabs, if you want. 11. I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Okay? Pointless to read the rest of it. The point we're trying to make here, okay, your letterhead says State of California. You present yourselves as California agents or government agents. Therefore, we're assuming that in order to occupy that noble position, you have to take an oath of office to occupy the public office. And how do we know that? Well, we know that because 63C, Amjur 2nd, public officers and employees, section 247, as expressed otherwise, the powers delegated to a public officer are held in trust for the people and are to be exercised in behalf of the government or of all citizens who may need the intervention of the officer. Not forced upon, who may need. Furthermore, The view has been expressed that all public officers within whatever branch and whatever level of government and whatever be their private vocations are trustees of the people. And accordingly, labor under every... Let me do this because this jumps. And accordingly, labor under every disability and prohibition imposed by law upon trustees relative to the making of personal financial gain from a discharge of their trust and owes a fiduciary duty to the public. Now, that's key. That's a contract. It has been said that the fiduciary responsibility of the public officer cannot be less than those of private individual. Furthermore, it has been stated that any enterprise undertaken by the public official who tends to weaken public confidence and undermine the sense of security for individual rights is against public policy. Fraud, in its elementary common law sense of deceit, and this is one of the meanings that fraud bears, 4083 U.S. 372, in the statute. A public official is a fiduciary toward the public, and if he deliberately conceals material information from them, he is guilty of fraud. That pretty much says it. Do I need to add anything to it? Thank you. So we said, it looks like, you know, you guys are not respecting your oath of office, and this is what you're supposed to do as a public official. It's not my rules. They're there for you. You're a representative of the people. Pretty clear. You have a fiduciary duty. So now we go into details, and this is where your stepping on my toes part begins. This was a general, hey, that was the hey part. Now I say, you are stepping on my toes. It starts in these seven detailed points. A, paragraph A. Agents appear to deceitfully reclassify the non-taxpayer into taxpayer status. Exhibit X. And I'm going to go to this Exhibit X. We need to address that. Revenue laws relate to taxpayers. I didn't say it. Plumbing and Heating Co. VUS said it. Revenue laws relate to taxpayers and not to non-taxpayers. Okay. Revenue provisions distinguish between taxpayer and non-taxpayer. I didn't say it. Tomlinson v. Smith said it. In Long v. Rasmussen, Collector D.C. So, the court, in construing the revenue provisions in question, properly, so we think, makes a distinction between suits instituted by taxpayers and non-taxpayers. The former, so it is held, are within the scope of the inhibition, but the latter are not. We don't need to go into details of the case. All we need to address, there is taxpayer, recognizes difference from non-taxpayer. The U.S. Senate recognizes the taxpayer as a separate person, distinct from the non-taxpayer. Exhibit 3, and we have that exhibit for you here on today. Let me just finish this paragraph. Throughout time, the courts have recognized the natural rights as the foundational principles. I wonder what those would be. Every man has a natural right to the fruit of his own labor, and no other person can rightfully deprive him of those fruits and appropriate them against his will. The antelope settled in 1825. And also, so throughout time, the courts have recognized and upheld non-taxpayers' rights. Who said that? Okay. No procedure is prescribed for non-taxpayers, and no attempt is made to annul any of their rights and remedies in due course of law. With them, non-taxpayers, Congress does not assume to deal, and they are neither of the subject nor of the object of the revenue laws. That's Economy, Plumbing, Heating. And guess what? That's not an old case. That's a 1972 case. Okay? Now, I'm going to need to go here real quick. Exhibit X. So bear with me. Yeah, don't. Listen, I was up all night.
Put them in order.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Just 1 second. And this totally screwed up my my screen because it goes through that machine and the computer acts so funny when it goes through that machine. I am lost. What is this? If you guys see it, I'm looking for one that says Seminar 710. Yeah, that's what I'll do. Thank you very much. See, I knew it. There it is. Oh, yeah. Okay. I promised you Exhibit 3 and Exhibit X. Let's start with Exhibit 3. Exhibit 3 is hearing before a subcommittee of the Committee on Finance, United States Senate, and Legislative History of the Current Tax Payment Act of 1943, page 140. And this is what they were saying. It seems to me the essential difference is that withholding tax plan applies at the point of receipt of income. That's the key word right there. And this applies at the point of expenditure of income. So they're talking about two different taxes at this point, irrelevant for what our discussion is. However, of course, withholding agents withhold not only from taxpayers, but non-taxpayers. There you go. There's another non-taxpayers issue there. Statement of Milton Friedman, Division of Tax Research, Treasury Department, next page on page 141. Senator Danner, I have only one other thought on that point, talking about the difference between these things. In the event of withholding from owner of stock, or anything else could be, and no taxes due ultimately, where does he get his refund? On your page there, I made you circle, no tax due ultimately. Yeah, I don't remember. Somebody took my copy. That's okay. It says no tax is due ultimately. That's a language used, and that's the same language they're using here. Where does he get his refund?
Three on top.
Okay. So you think of a corporation or an individual? I'm talking about an individual. All right, so Mr. Friedman, who must have known what he was talking about, says an individual will file an income tax return, and that income tax return will constitute an automatic claim for refund. If that is not misleading, what is? Because the only thing I can conclude from this is that, okay, so basically I can screw up all day long filing those W-4s, and I put the wrong amount of, if I think I belong in their sandbox, I put the wrong amount of independence and everything else. But if I screwed up, no big deal, because I file this and I make that form correct, and then it's an automatic claim for refund if I overpaid. Does that sound reasonable to assume? Yes, no?
Yes.
Maybe so?
This.
Okay. Oh, this. So on Exhibit 3, this is what we did. In Notice and Demand 4, first of all, this exhibit was sent with one of the Notice and Demands prior to this one. However, what we do when we send this to become an exhibit, we also put these red circles here that show the cases that appear to support whatever is in that exhibit. The reason we do so and recommend to do so, in case you end up in court, a jury may not want to bother to look at all the cases and everything else, but when they like looking at exhibits. Have you noticed? They look for exhibits. One of the first things. Okay, so let's see. Ah, pretty girl. There you go. And there you go. Revenue laws relate to taxpayers and not to non-taxpayers, which supports what they're talking about, taxpayers and non-taxpayers in the above section, right? A reasonable construction of taxing statutes does not include vesting any tax official with absolute power of assessment against individuals not specified in the statutes as a person liable for the tax without an opportunity for judicial review of this status before the appellation of taxpayer is bestowed upon them. That's interesting. Every man has a natural right to the fruits of his own labor. I think jurors would agree to that. And no other person can rightfully deprive him of those fruits. We know of no case in which a legislative act to transfer the property of A to B without his consent has ever been held a constitutional exercise of legislative power in any state in the Union. On the contrary, it has been constantly resisted and inconsistent with just principles by every judicial tribunal in which it has been attempted to be enforced. And that's why we made this Exhibit 3, because if they get bored to go to Exhibit 33, at least they get the foundation of the principles under which we're coming with these issues. Make sense? All right.
Clear as mud.
I'm sorry?
Clear as mud.
Good. And we didn't say any of this. We're just using their words and going back to it. Now, there was another exhibit I promised. That was Exhibit X. And the reason we're going to need to look at this exhibit is because this is what they said, and this is what you all have. All right? And I'll bring your attention now to the portion where what is it they claim about, and you circled it, I believe it's page 3. Well, I'm looking for the one where they address. Okay, there it is, page 2. On the bottom of page 2. As stated above, California law defines who is required to file a tax return, as well as tax liability obligations. Attempts to portray oneself as a non-taxpayer, sovereign citizen, or freeborn or natural individual with immunity from taxation lack legal support and are ineffective claims against the proper assessment and collection of taxes. Okay. Okay, let's raise it. Okay? So that's what they're saying. And they're using as example CUS v. Studley, Ninth Circuit, 1986. Okay? Now the question is, we quoted Supreme Court cases beforehand. Does this Ninth Circuit trump Supreme Court cases?
They're always wrong anyway.
I understand, but, you know, does this Ninth Circuit...
No.
Okay, would trump Supreme Court case? So... let's say maybe these guys figured out something that we don't know, but we inquisitive minds want to know. So we're going to ask. So further we go. Yes.
In California, the Ninth Circuit is the superior court.
Yes.
So
we're talking about Supreme Court.
Well, but in this jurisdiction, wouldn't that be the law, though?
I understand. Let me just bring out a point, though. What the gentleman is saying, if you didn't hear, is that the superior court in California is the supreme jurisdiction. What we're claiming coming at common law, we're claiming that common law court of record, is the supreme jurisdiction because it's been recognized, as you will later find out, as equal or superior to the United States Supreme Court. All right? All right. Right. So when you get familiar with 1215.org and you do all that homework, you'll reach a level of confidence, I hope, that will encourage you to pursue this direction. Everybody's direction has a purpose and is good. We're not knocking anybody's approach. What we're hoping to achieve is everybody joining in so that we can network these things and be able to communicate with one another your findings, our cases, express it in a classroom environment, again, networking, and being able to now 500 of us attorneys be able to get together in one session and whatever they hide, being able to point it out and spin it back on them. We don't cost anything. Their 500 attorneys cost a lot. There's a question back there. 1 second, and then I'll come.
The Ninth Circuit Court, Supreme Court name, or is it a court of records?
Did you want to answer that? He's asking you a question.
No. I mean, I wasn't going against the common law principle that we're doing here. I'm just saying if we're referencing their court, the Ninth Circuit, if it's a federal court in California and it goes to appeal, it goes to the Ninth Circuit.
Right.
So if the Ninth Circuit says something for the courts in California, that's binding. In other words, for the federal courts. But we're talking about common law court, then we're out
right.
of that.
He's asking if the Superior Court, the Ninth Circuit, is a court of record.
It's an appeals court. It's not a trial court. So.
Okay. Your question was if it's a superior court?
Is it Supreme Court a name or is it a court of record?
It's a, for all intents and purposes, let's say, is the highest court in California. Which makes it a statutory high court. It's a statutory court. It's
so it's not a court of record?
It's not. Well, it's not a court of record unless you make it. You can turn that court into a court of record.
Right.
Your presence establishes the court of record.
So
is that unclear, the court of record? We'll go over that later. Yes? Just be patient. We'll go over that later. What is that? How does this become a court of record document if they try to keep it out? If I forget, please remind us. Right? Write your own notes and questions. Yes, you had a question.
I noticed that you have different addresses for the Franchise Tax Board.
The lady noticed we have different addresses for the Franchise Tax Board. Good. Yes, we do. Let me go back to the document and address that right away. The reason for the different addresses is because what these people do, the ones that love you closest are in your general neighborhood. But you have love letters from people in Sacramento, okay? And then you have love letters from, where is this one? From Rancho Cordova. So we didn't bother finding out why Santa Ana, where we are right now, sends you these hearings in Santa Ana. You have letters coming from Rancho Cordova, the ones that solicit you for payment of taxes. And then you have details, as decisive details coming from California pertaining to what this guy here, like Lisa Martini, is one of the hearing officers here in Santa Ana. She is the officer that said in this particular case that I have no authority. And these guys from Sacramento said, based on her information and her input, they concluded, they determined that Yoda tax that he is by his final plus penalties. Okay, so they work hand in hand.
What was the last thing you said?
They work hand in hand. They be based on her determination, based on her advice, or based on her assessment of the situation of the hearing, they concluded that the process is now final, and you owe penalties, and the liability or the debt has been established by their administrative record. That's what they claim.
By her no authority that she
prepared. By her no authority, right, that she does not exercise. They all of a sudden decided, hey, whatever she says, yeah, we're going to give her authority so that we can enforce this this debt onto you. Yes, thank you. Any other questions before I follow through? No. Okay. So as follows, where were we? We were right here. Okay. So we're done with paragraph A. That was the first. Hey, you kept stepping on my tiptoe. B. Agents ignore the distinction between taxpayer and non-taxpayer, as we obviously witnessed, and acted without a judicial review. Such review is part of due process and is essential to shield people from being injured by administrative presumptions of status. Agents have no judicial authority to determine people's relinquishment of rights, which must be established before the appellation of taxpayer is bestowed upon them. Did we say that? No. Judicial review is a determination of the rights of an individual under the existing laws, is an exercise of judicial power. Obviously does not belong to an administrative agent who appears might not even be a government agent. An essential element of judicial power is that it requires the ascertainment of existing rights, which is also supported by the next footnote, which says, due process requires that when governmental agencies, which they might not be, that adjudicate or make binding determinations which directly affect legal rights of individuals, they use procedures which have traditionally been associated with judicial process. All right? And agents have no judicial authority to determine people's relinquishment of rights. There is a presumption against the waiver of constitutional rights. See so-and-so cases, Supreme Court. And for a waiver to be effective, it must be clearly established that there was an intentional relinquishment or abandonment of a known right or privilege. Which means they cannot just presume. There has to be some, they have to have some solid proof before they proceed. And here is the beauty. A reasonable construction of the taxing statutes does not include vesting any tax official with absolute power and assessment against individuals not specified in the statutes as a person liable for the tax without an opportunity for judicial review of this status before the appellation of taxpayer. What do they do? Dear taxpayer. That's one of the first letters. If they don't have dear taxpayer, there's your social security number there and says tax year. Whenever you have a tax year, it automatically implies, they want to make it like automatic, imply that you're a taxpayer. It's a hint that they perceive you as a taxpayer. All right? C, agents mail, again, we're in the category, this is what you guys do or you don't do, and because of this, you're going to create some harm. Agents mailed no certified copies. Yes, we're going to go up. Thank you. Agents mailed no certified copies to inform me of any verified proof of liability. Why do we need these? Why would a certified copy be necessary? Because a certified copy is a copy of a document or record signed and certified as a true copy by the officer to whose custody the original is entrusted. They can't just fantasize about this. They have to have a document there to have a certified copy to inform. Why should they inform? Well, because the California Government Code Section 54950 dictates so to a government official. The people insist on remaining informed so that they may retain control over the instruments they have created. I think that's pretty clear language. Okay, and verified. What does verified mean? Verification means confirmation of correctness, truth, and authenticity by affidavit, oath, or deposition. That's a California Appeals, 2nd 4748. Okay? And that shows a proof of liability for a specific tax. Keep in mind the well-settled rule that the citizen is exempt from taxation unless the same is imposed in clear and unequivocal language, and that where the construction of a law is doubtful, the doubt is to be resolved in favor of those upon whom the tax is sought to be laid. Isn't that what they're trying to do? They're trying to lay a tax. But, you know, they say, well, unless you put on W-4 exempt and whatever, it shouldn't make a difference because the citizen is presumed exempt to start with. Yeah, we can make a mistake. Okay? Agents reach beyond constitutional boundaries when they act based on personal opinions or popular beliefs, which are not laws, statutes, regulations, or judicial reviews. The reason I point these laws, statutes, regulations there is because those are the keys or the trigger mechanisms that would give them some jurisdiction. They can't just assume, and we're going to address that immediately here. However, let's not forget, an unconstitutional act is not law. It confers no rights, it imposes no duties. So if they're acting unconstitutionally, without making presumptions, then there it is. Since slavery was abolished, nowhere in the Constitution are statutory enactments allowed to compel transfers of rights or property without informed consent. Did I just make that up? Well, the Constitution says the organic law is the Constitution of government and is altogether written. Other written laws are denominated statutes. Okay, so there's laws and statutes. The written law of this state is therefore contained in its Constitution and statutes, and that's the operative here, operative word, and in the Constitution and statutes of the United States. Why is that important? Because that means we can bring in constitutional issues at the United States level. Okay, what are statutory enactments? Well, the 6th article of the Constitution of the United States declares that the laws made in pursuance thereof, it shall be the supreme law of the land, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. By this declaration, the states are prohibited from passing any acts which shall be repugnant to a law of the United States. So this one reinforces that one right before it. Allowed to compel transfers of rights of property without informed consent. We know of no case in which a legislative act to transfer the property of A to B without his consent has ever been held a constitutional exercise of legislative power in the state of the union. A show of hands. Who consented? Anybody consented here? That you last know you consented to this? On the contrary, it has been constantly resisted and inconsistent with just principles by every judicial tribunal in which it has been attempted to be enforced. The statutory scheme offers programs to members who consent to participate by voluntarily entering the jurisdiction of a particular program, Social Security, for example, for specific privileges or benefits. Now, what are those? A voluntary acceptance of the benefit of a transaction is equivalent to a consent to all obligations arising from it, so far as the facts are known or ought to be known to the person accepting. California Civil Code, Section 1589. Helpful. Membership to such programs creates specific excise taxable liabilities which become payable through taxpayer compliance. What is a specific excise taxable liability? Excises are taxes laid upon the manufacture, sell, or consumption of commodities within the country, upon licenses to pursue certain occupations, and upon corporate privileges. Operative word, certain occupations, not all occupations. The requirement to pay such taxes involves the exercise of privileges and the element of absolute and unavoidable demand is lacking. Do we need to work that on, or we understand what that means? The element of absolute and unavoidable demand is lacking, which means it has to be voluntary participation, which become payable through taxpayer compliance. What does that mean? Our system of taxation is based on voluntary assessment and payment, not upon the straight forced arrest. United States v. Flora, U.S. 1958. Okay? So, the delegated legislative powers limit taxation to specific means, reasons, and circumstances. We can't generalize, right? Agents are not endowed with the power to exert presumptions on non-participants to this statutory scheme, right? Who are not within their authority. In the United States, sovereignty resides in the people who act through the organs established by the Constitution. 3, 4, 5 cases. The Congress, as the instrumentality of sovereignty, is endowed with certain powers to be exerted on behalf of the people in the manner and with the effect of the Constitution ordains. The Congress cannot invoke the sovereign power of the people to override their will as thus declared. So the question is, which one of you wanted me to pay taxes? Well, you're the people, right? These people claim they have your authority to write to me and say, well, you're a taxpayer. Question, yes?
That Penn Hollow versus Stone's administrators there?
Yes.
It's not a good case, I'm afraid.
Which one?
It's the second one quoted, after Chisholm versus Georgia.
Right. This came as a quote of this particular case, Perry v. Witt, United States. This was extracted from a...
Okay.
Right. So if that case is not a good case... Right. That's why there's 4 or 5 of them.
Yeah.
All right. So if one is wrong, well, sorry. Big deal. I got 4 others. That's the way we look at it. And, by the way, you'll find out in the end of this that we put a provision that if anything here appears to be in disagreement... Sure, rebut it. We'll strike that out. We're here for communication. We're here to exchange what we have, what you guys have,
honor.
You know.
Honor.
Yeah, that's good.
Honor. To honor, yes. There you go. Thank you.
That's good.
All right. Good. The delegated legislative powers, okay, within their authority. People have no general liability for excise taxes, occupation taxes, taxes on income. I happen to know what says ahead, so... Oh, come on. Or taxes on income, which are not the same as the direct taxes on property. Those are strong statements, aren't they? Let's see if we can support them. What is... Here, let's see how I can make this easy. People have no general liability for excise taxes. Remember, we addressed excises before. Now this is excise taxes. A tax laid upon the happening of an event, as distinguished from its tangible fruits, is an indirect excise tax. A tax laid upon the happening of an event, as distinguished from its tangible fruits. So an excise tax is something that is the event, not the money I get, for example, as a tangible fruit, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Occupation taxes, what are those? It was, therefore, an occupation tax, and being a state tax also, the section authorizing it is in conflict with the Constitution. In the opinion of the Chief Justice, he reviewed the decisions of this court in the cases of Washington v. Somebody and Standard Oil and so on. And the review of the cases was summarized by him as follows. The effect of these decisions, undoubtedly, is that the state cannot tax occupations generally, but must find its power to tax outside of this restriction. The power was found in Baker case and in the gasoline case in the right to tax the franchise of a corporations as a, again, privilege tax and the tax to use the public highways. All right. Now, let's go next page. Is this helpful in any way?
Yes.
Good. Or taxes on income. Now let's address taxes by itself. So we first addressed excises, then we addressed excise taxes, now we're addressing taxes. The state is without power to impose either an income or occupation tax for state purposes. And the court below was, therefore, correct in withholding that act unconstitutional, and that decree is affirmed. Taxes on income. Income, what is income? We had that circled. Has been taken to mean the same thing as used in the corporation, Excise Tax Act. And they say it's the same in the 16th Amendment and the same in the various revenue acts subsequently passed. Well, if it's the same in the 16th and if it's the same in the revenue acts and it's defined as excise tax in the 1909 Act, can it be an excise and a non-excise? If it's the same, the definition of same, two things similar are not the same. So they don't say similar, they say same. Yes?
Yes.
All right. Which are not the same as the direct taxes. So those are indirect. Which are not the same as the direct taxes on property. California income tax is not a tax on property. California income tax is not a tax on property. Loud and clear. In the matter of appeals of Fred who? Dauberger. Remember that name I asked you to? All right.
There he is.
All right. We didn't say it. They said it. California income tax is not a tax on property. That's good to know. Thank you very much. Agents provided no statutes supporting their assessment and determinations of deficiency for the alleged liabilities or penalties. Also, agents provided no implementing regulations and sent no certified copies of any verified, we addressed those terms already, right? Deficiency, which might make me subject to agents' authority or might give agents lawful reasons to keep my funds. Now, what are statutes? 10th Circuit Court of Appeals said in United States v. Community Soho, without question, a taxing statute must describe with some certainty, that doesn't mean ambiguous, the transaction, okay, service, or object to be taxed, or object. Okay, should we include in that object income? Is income an object? Describe anything we read thus far. Is income an object? And in a typical situation, it is construed against the government if it's ambiguous. Okay, well, we'll park that for the time being until we address it later. All right. Also, agents provided no implementing regulations. Why are those necessary? Because this case here, California Bankers v. Schultz, it's a Supreme Court case, 1974. We think it important to note, they think it important, Supreme Court, to note that the Act's civil and criminal penalties attach only upon violations of regulations, not violations of statute. Right? And the Act would impose no penalties upon anyone. Only those who violate these regulations may incur civil or criminal penalties. Let's stop here for a second. The question would, in a logical mind, would arise, okay, to follow some regulations, like you go to Walmart, if you work for them, you got to follow their rules. So regulations are a book by which you should act. At which point did you enter the position to have to follow those regulations? And who do those regulations apply to? Would that be a logical question? Yes. Bill has a question, a comment.
Yeah. Regulations are the law of the executive branch.
Sorry about that.
There we go. You have the legislature has its rules. You've heard of the rules of the Senate, and you know, Senate rules, and you've heard the congressional rules. Well, those rules are the law of that branch of government. Then you have the laws that are passed by Congress for everybody to kind of go by. Okay? But there's a separation of powers doctrine which says that no one branch can control another branch. So what they do, the legislature creates a law. The executive branch now creates a regulation in conformance with the law, and that's what they follow. You may have heard of Bush doing signing statements where he effectively neutralized it. Well, that's what's happening. They can't force that on him. Now they can impeach him if he gets too disrespectful, but they cannot force it on him. And so the executive branch now makes regulations. The regulations get published in the Federal Register, and then now that's implemented. It's public notice and implemented. The departments in the executive branch then make rules in accordance with the regulations. So the regulations are kind of like a reflection of the statutes and codes, but the rules are the micromanagement which cannot violate the regulations. And now you have the third branch, which is called the judicial branch, and they have their rules of court, and that's the law for that branch. So when we talk about rules and regulations, we typically mean the executive branch. We're talking about Senate rules, congressional rules, we're talking about statutes and codes, which kind of like is a guide to everybody. And then you have the rules of court, which is the law of the court branch. So does that clarify now what we mean when we talk about the regulations? And the same thing, the same pattern works in the state level as well. The states have their three branches of government. Okay.
What was the law that said one can't do the other?
Separation of powers doctrine says that no one branch. For example, you've heard of licensed attorneys. You looked at the Business and Professions Code, and it says that you cannot practice law without a license, and you have to have an endorsement on the back of the license saying you've taken the oath of office and all that. They can't enforce that against the attorneys because all the attorneys get their permission to practice in the courts from the courts. Okay? So that practicing law without a license can't be enforced against the unlicensed attorneys because they are operating by authority of the separate judicial branch. Okay, so hopefully that clarifies that issue too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
all right.
Tricky.
Yes, there you are.
Thank you. Are we reading at a good pace here? Everybody good? Okay, thanks. So let's just catch up with this. So also agents provided no implementing regulations and send no certified copies of any verified deficiency which might make me subject to agents' authority or might give agents lawful reasons to keep my funds. Such lawful reasons could be, 1, if I entered a contract by which I owed a duty to the state. 40, the individual owes no duty to the state, since he receives nothing therefrom beyond the protection of his life and property. His rights are such as existed by the law of the land long antecedent to the organization of the state. He owes nothing to the public so long as he does not trespass upon their rights. Okay, so we don't think we owe a duty to the state. If I owed a franchise tax, what is that monster? Because they addressed franchise earlier. Franchise tax is a tax on franchise of a corporation. That resonates with what they were saying before. On the right and privilege, again, privilege and rights, but now rights and privileges of a carrying on business in the character of a corporation. I don't see people there. For the purposes for which it was created and in the conditions which surround it. All right. For a trade or business, they said, right? Or business. Okay, let's see what that means. Congress cannot authorize a trade or business within a state in order to tax it. Helpful. That's a helpful hint. In the character of a corporation or public officer, which may carry a duty to the state. Maybe it would. All subjects over which the sovereign power of a state extends are objects of taxation. But those over which it does not extend are, upon the soundest principles, again, we're talking about fundamental principles, exempt from taxation. Remember the citizen exempt from taxation? The sovereignty of a state extends to everything which exists by its own authority or is introduced by its permission. Another situation that might be lawful reasons. If anything were conferred to me as a franchised special privilege. So, this is a franchise tax. This is franchise. Franchise, what that is. Franchise, a special privilege. Again, privilege. Conferred by government on individual. Oh, so they can tax an individual. A taxpayer is an individual. Remember that, right? The definition. They say that in the franchise tax board notice. It says a special privilege conferred upon by government on individual or corporation and which does not belong to citizens of country generally of common right. Oh, okay. So something that I wouldn't have normally. Special privilege which does not belong to the people or citizens of the country as a matter of common right. Now, what would that be? Judge Smith then reviews all our previous decisions, whether or not it is within the power of a legislature under article so-and-so, to tax occupations which are of common right, and correctly announces the doctrine of these cases to be the state cannot tax for revenue purposes occupations which are of common right. Now, if an income tax is neither a property tax nor a tax on pursuits and occupations that are of common right, then an income tax law is properly framed is not inhibited by article so-and-so, which provides that all property subject to taxation shall be taxed according to its value, ascertained in a manner to make it equal and uniform throughout the state. I don't see graduate there.
Right.
Okay, graduate income tax, no, equal and uniform. Okay, so they cannot be talking about the income tax here, right? And that hawkers, peddlers, ferries, exhibitions and privileges in the same category. So if the income tax is a privilege tax, fits in the same category with these other guys, may be taxed in such manner as the legislator deems proper. Well, if they're subject of it, sure. Now, hawkers and peddlers, we looked up last night, midnight, the term. You want to address that? Hawkers and peddlers? He's so charming when he does these things. I'm going to let him do that.
Yeah, we
didn't sleep, so
we learned a little bit about that subject. A peddler is somebody who goes door to door carrying his stock with him and selling stuff. Okay, that's local. A hawker.
Peddler is the other way
around. Oh, he's interstate.
Yeah. Inter.
And the hawker.
Intra.
Hawker is intra.
Intra.
Right. Okay. And peddler is well. Anyway, look it up. Okay? Right. You got a dictionary, look it up. But basically the sense of it is that a peddler and a hawker are pretty much the same, but one seems to be intrastate, whereas the other one crosses into the commerce, crosses the state line type thing. They're from out of the area. And then we learned another thing. Do you have any idea what a mystery is? A mystery.
The tax code.
Well, that's a nice try, but that's not it. Anybody else want to guess what a mystery is?
Something unrevealed.
No. A mystery is a how should I say it?
Mastery.
Well, it's like an occupation.
Really?
Really. The legal meaning of mystery is occupation. And it comes from the idea, you know, you have artisans who practice their art.
Mastery.
And they master their art, and what they do is a mystery to the unwashed. Okay? And so the mystery is an occupation. Look it up in the legal dictionary. That's where we found it. I was mystified by what I found.
Example, Chris Angel.
Chris, I don't know that one.
Okay.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Yeah,
he's a magician.
Anyway. Yeah. So, yes, sir. Bob, you have a comment, Bob?
I was just going to ask, is the franchise tax board then considered a mystery?
Yes, it would be, actually, because that's their specialized occupation, what they do, and we sure can't understand it.
Although we're
doing pretty good now at knocking down the barriers. So, okay, I guess that's, yes, sir.
So is a mystery taxable then?
Is a mystery taxable, yes. Yes, it would be.
If you can find it.
Yeah, if it's commercial activity. Okay. Yes, but, you know, if you're not engaged in commerce, not taxable, right?
That's what
not regulatable.
Peddlers are.
Right. Okay, back to you, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, the commerce aspect is pretty, it seems to be pretty uniform throughout everything they say. So they make you appear like you're engaged in some commercial activity, and the give up is in the trade or business expression, and it's used as a trade or business expression, okay, which we're going to address right here. You remember that, trade or business. However, Congress cannot authorize a trade or business within the state in order to tax it. So when they say trade or business and it's in the Revenue and Taxation Code, they have to be talking about something else than trade or business. If it's something that they cannot tax, then this trade or business has to be some secret code term that they're using. Yes, sir.
Yeah, in the IRS code, trade or business is includes the functions of a public office.
That's you got it. The terminology, for those of you that are not familiar with the term includes, the IRS claims that the term includes means also includes. So whatever you imagine, but also includes this, which cannot be a definition if we look at what a definition should be, right? Definition should be something very, very, very well defined, and includes is kind of generic.
Can I finish the seminar?
My pleasure. I gotta go sleep.
Anyway, the word include is different from the words like including and includes and so forth. It turns out that, and verify this on the dictionary, because I'm saying this extemporaneously and I haven't reviewed my knowledge of that. But there's one word that they, when they say such and such and such includes blah, 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 it excludes everything else.
Yes. Really?
Okay? Yes. Includes blah, blah, blah. If it's not on that list, it's not part of it. But if you use a similar sounding word, we say this including blah, then it's all encompassing. So look it up in the dictionary and verify for yourself the precise meanings of the different variations of the word include. But one of them is restrictive, puts a fence around whatever is on the list.
Montello Salt versus Utah, 1911. It's restrictive. So they use a play on words. They say includes and including. It's not the same as Bill said. It's not include.
Right. That's why I didn't want to go into that. I just hinted at it. We addressed that in the previous notice and demands. That's why I suggested doing the workshops, because you'll get more familiar with all those words of art, so-called words of art. And this is solely for the purpose, since it's such a long document, solely for the purpose of getting familiar with what a notice and demand is, where it fits, and being able to draw upon these cases that we bring forward here and use them in your own situations for those who feel strong enough to take them to court. If not, maybe then we'll talk about organizing ourselves in the forums, show and tell workshops. Fair enough. So, such lawful reasons could be, if anywhere, well, okay, matter of common right. So we beat that that horse there? Yes. Okay, and special privileges. Okay, special privileges. Well, they defined it here as a special privilege, saying it's, if it's not a special privilege, it's an occupation of common right. And we addressed that prior as far as privileges as well. Okay? Another reason, lawful reason, that might, you know, turn off the dogs. If I requested or used state or state benefits. Okay, well, what could that mean? Used state or state benefits. Let's see why that's there. It is to be noted that the statute differentiates between states of the union, states, and foreign states by the use of a capital S for the word when applied to a state of the United States. I wonder if they do the same thing in their codes, because we see in the Revenue and Taxation Code spelled both ways, and then you have in this state, in the state, all over the place, okay? And spelled like that, and then spelled like this, like with a capital S as well. So we want to know. We're going to ask specific questions about that. We're not going to presume, assume, conclude anything. And then state benefits. Now here we're going to address benefits. And guess what we found? That railroad benefits, like Social Security benefits, are not contractual and may be altered or even eliminated at any time. We must conclude that a person covered by the Act has not such a right in benefit payments. Keep investing, people. This is not to say, however, that Congress may exercise its power to modify the statutory scheme free of all constitutional restraint. I have received letters and interpretations, and I've heard other people misreading this. And I need to pause on this, because this is not to say that negation pertains to the second part. However, that Congress may exercise its power to modify the statutory scheme free of all constitutional restraint. Did that make a difference? In other words, what we believe this is saying, that even though Congress has the power to do whatever they please, still they cannot exercise the statutory scheme free of constitutional restraint without observing constitutional restraints.
So they left out a preposition or phrase to be more, you know, more particular in description.
Simpler put, they cannot pass any statutes that are not constitutional. How's that? That's what we draw from that. Some people say, no, that means something, it means the opposite, that they can exercise everything. We disagree with that.
Constitution is the highest law of the land.
Basically, since government comes after the Constitution is the law, the books for them. Obviously, the binding chains of the Constitution are embraced. They cannot place even the statutes, especially statutes that may have to come, that we may have to interact with. For example, we want to go and participate. We're crazy. We want to participate in Social Security, right? We want to participate in Social Security. That's a statute. Okay. We interact with that statute. However, the way they write the rules and regulations for that, when in interaction with us, cannot provide the environment of unconstitutionality.
What about treaties? When the government goes into the signing of treaties with foreign countries without our consent or without our acknowledgement or our participation,
well,
and then they just come out with them and say, "Oh, we just did this."
I would have no problem with them signing whatever treaties as long as they don't put my name as a liable party to their treaties. They are allowed to do such things, but they are not allowed to do, again, anything outside the... The purpose for the Constitution was to protect us from outside enemies and inside enemies. And if you look at the oath of office, it's pretty clear, right? I hereby swear, right? Constitutional oath. Yes.
I have a question. I don't know if it's true, but I was told that Hillary Clinton signed a treaty with the United Nations to ban firearms or handguns. It did not pass. Okay, thanks.
Well, a side comment for that, although this is not about it, or real quick, make sure you look up the definition of firearms. I sent that out on the internet. They're being deceitful about that. It's basically what they consider statutorily firearm is something that doesn't have threaded barrel. And it's something less than 16 or 18 inch, I forget what it is. Okay? So they use deceptive language, deceitful, and you use it deceitfully. And you think, oh, everybody turning their firearms and whatever, and there you go with your threaded barrel, and you don't know. Okay? So look up those definitions. They're in 26 U.S.C. There are some definitions there, and for those who need that, I can give you that information. Okay, so another reason would be if I had a tax liability. So what is a tax liability now? So we had liability for tax. Now it's a tax liability, privileges, benefits. Tax liability is a condition precedent to what? To the demand. Merely demanding payment, even repeatedly, does not cause liability. And this is our, what do you call this, solar plexus here? Because, okay, so 1983 case. Liability must be before they can make any demands. So we start from the premise of this notice and demand and the entire cycle of notices and demands to bring them to the brink of a lawsuit in case. They don't clarify which is the liability. How did they arrive? First of all, it had to be a liability for them to decide that somebody is a taxpayer. Okay? And absent liability, how did they acquire jurisdiction to declare somebody taxpayer? Okay? If anything were given to me for which the state or the state, let's say there's two different monsters out there I'm not aware of, can ask return. And as was said in Wisconsin v. J.C. Penney, the simple but controlling question is whether the state has given anything for which it can ask return. 1975 case, Supreme Court. Without a meaningful meeting of the minds on essential elements, there can be no enforceable contract. Basically, if I'm not aware that Social Security, since most of us are participants in that, we think of it as, oh, what? Maybe, is it a contract? Is it a benefit? Is it welfare? Let's say we don't know, and we want to ask. What are the essential elements of a contract? Anyone entering into an agreement with the government takes the risk of having accurately ascertained that he who purports to act for the government stays within the bounds of his authority, even though the agent himself may not be aware of the limitations upon his authority. He took an oath. Is he aware of the limitations? Should he be aware of the limitations? Did he swear an oath to the agency? No, he swore an oath to uphold the Constitution. And we saw in that amjur, in the very beginning, what the official duties are and what standards of conduct they are being held at. So, there can be no enforceable contract. There was a total absence of proof of the appellee's assent to the alleged agreement or that its terms and conditions were free from doubt, speculation, and conjecture of that were was a sufficient meeting of the minds of the parties to establish an agreement. So is the Social Security a contract? It's not. We sign a W-4. Does that mean, is that a contract now that makes this everybody liable for something we're not aware of? Where do I find that? These are legitimate questions. And these are legitimate questions, and we want simple, clear answers. Agents ignored my rights and issued garnishment orders. Now we go from not only they stepped on my toe, we said, hey, you're kind of stepping on my toe. So they turned around and said, so what? All right, so this is where we get into where they say, so what? E. Agents ignored my rights. So, so what? The rights of individual, of the individual, now individual, they say taxpayer is an individual. Are they don't say a taxpayer individual, they say the individual, are not derived from governmental agencies, either municipal, state, or federal, or even from the Constitution. That's good to know. They exist inherently in every man by endowment of the Creator, and are merely reaffirmed in the Constitution and restricted only to the extent that they have been voluntarily surrendered by the citizenship to the agencies of government. The people's rights are not derived from the government, but the government's authority comes from the people. So they ignored that, and they issued garnishment orders. A brief history into this particular case. This guy took a leave of absence and went to Europe for about a year and a half. They started sending letters and whatever. And he said, look, he filled out those forms. I don't have a liability. I didn't work. All right. What they did, they said, well, no, you have to prove that. How you made a living. You have to prove that you were traveling because based on your license or whatever work you have and the average income of others in your position, you made $40,000. You owe $4,000 to the franchise tax board. Okay? So the guy said, well, I don't think, you know, please show me where. I don't think you're allowed to assume that. I think you're exceeding your authority there to ask me for all those nonsense details. My statement is my statement. You have something to prove otherwise? And they issued EWATs, earning withholding order for taxes. Thank you. Order for taxes. And the employer paid them.
Yeah.
So, and they did that without valid verification of a debt or judgment. And it says there, the debt collector shall cease collection of the debt or any disputed portion thereof until the debt collector obtains verification of the debt or a copy of the judgment. So they didn't have verification because the guy asked for it. They didn't provide it. They proceeded in garnishment, and they didn't have a judgment either. There was no case, no nothing. They just tricked the employer into handing over the money. And the copy of such verification or judgment, 15 U.S.C. section 1692, okay? Okay, they ignored my objections. Why would my objections mean anything? Well, let's see. The defendant collecting the money, which we just witnessed, the defendant in this case being the government, and it is alleged that he still has it. Well, they still have it. He was notified when he received it that the plaintiff disputed his right. Hey, I didn't work. I didn't make any money. If he had no right, as he had not, to collect the money, his doing so in the name of the state cannot protect him. All right? There's about four cases supporting that.
So wouldn't that be extortion?
Well, we don't want to say anything because we're going to let things, chips fall where they may. Well, we think so, yes. Both federal and state taxing agencies, well, extortion by deceit. Extortion by DC. They found a way around it. Remember how they are allowed to find a way around taxation? In the beginning, we addressed that. I don't expect you to remember all the cases. You'd go nuts. Both federal and state taxing agencies are subjects to the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, requiring original proof of debt, including any alleged tax debt. Okay? They also acted on mere presumptions. Okay, let's see what they say about that. The power to create presumptions is not a means of escape from constitutional restrictions. I love this case because it also supports what we were addressing earlier in the other case that I said that can the statute escape constitutional restrictions? And this is a reinforcement that we're correctly interpreting the previous case. Make sense?
Right.
Okay. If I lose you, please hold me back. All acts were conducted without any counter-testimony to my affidavits and this disregard of my requests, exhibit so-so-so, and my notices, exhibit so-so-so, which we will not have time to show you all these exhibits today. It would be way too long. We can do that if you want to associate and do some workshops. Agents also mailed unsigned penalties, exhibit so-5, and this is something about unsigned stuff. Revenue and Taxation Code, which is the California taxing code, says, in any proceeding involving the issue of whether or not any person is liable for a penalty under section so-and-so, the burden of proof with respect to that issue shall be on the Franchise Tax Board. And guess what? 19177 and 19179 and all those three sections are what you usually receive as penalties for filing either a frivolous return or whatever penalties they come at you under. All right?
19 or 19?
Yeah. Again, you don't need to. If you have computers, this will be readily available for you, hopefully tonight or tomorrow, and then you can do just exactly what I'm doing here. I just want we have to go over this so you understand where we're coming from. They'll be on the website, 1215.org.
Tonight,
okay.
At midnight?
Yeah, probably, because that's when we get there.
Right. Not tomorrow, but tonight.
Is there a similar code in the IRS?
We'll get there.
Okay,
as far as, yes. And if we don't address it, we'll look for one.
We'll
but I would suggest write a note for the question.
Okay.
Yeah, so we don't forget anything. There was another question. Please don't forget them. All right, so they verified the notice. All these exhibits here, there's tons of exhibits. Some of them are 200 page long. Determined taxes, exhibits 20 to 24, without jurisdiction. Now, why would jurisdiction matter? Well, let's see. Supreme Court says, the law requires proof of jurisdiction to appear on the record of the administrative agency and all administrative proceedings. I like that. I like that. So, are you going to see anything there? They claim jurisdiction, but there is no real proof of jurisdiction because in order to have it, there must be a pre-existing what? Liability. Yes, sir.
Are you going to submit a 200-page exhibit?
Yes.
No,
yes, we did.
You did?
Yes.
Done it already.
Yes. Well, that's the whole point here.
Yeah.
That becomes part of your case, and it shows. And it shows that the reason we want to do step 1, 2, 3 is because it establishes a pattern of behavior on their behalf. So we asked friendly, right? Is this an aggressive letter? No, but it's to the point. What is it? This or this, we have information about this. Please reciprocate. Honor, honor, honor. Total dishonor. Ambiguous answers. We receive answers from disclosure officers, Sacramento or somewhere else. So they pass the buck. When they don't understand something, goes in the next basket. That ends up 6 months later. You say, okay, 21 days. You have 21 days to respond or 30 days. If you need more time, please respond. They don't do it. You default them. They don't do it. Ends up somebody responds to a letter 6 months ago. We have that, by the way. And those are all exhibits showing a pattern, behavior pattern, which they're either interacting or acting, we don't know, within company policy. I'm not going to call them agencies since they don't want to be called agencies. Company policy. So we want to know. Friendly, fairly, squarely. That's the attitude I chose for these. So if you want to borrow that, you're welcome to use it. So request for clear, specific information. Exhibit so-and-so, 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 so-and-so. Persons dealing with the government are charged with knowing government statutes. Oh, there you go. And regulations. And they assume the risk that government agents may exceed their authority and provide misinformation. I've been warned in 1981 by the Ninth Circuit that I better ask for all these things or else.
Absolutely.
I'll be charged with knowing government statutes and regulations. So I'm totally comfortable to ask for statutes and regulations, aren't I? Because I cannot assume or take the risk that government agents may exceed their authority and provide misinformation. They're advising me, beware, buyer beware. Okay? That's not, it's not a law, but it's a case. I mean, it's a pretty widely expressed. Who am I to doubt, you know, Ninth Circuit? Second. You know? After agents, that's for me, that's legal advice. Okay? That comes from a pretty good authority in their statutory world, where they belong. Now, as if to add insult to injury, after agents scoffed at my raising constitutional safeguards, exhibit so-and-so, because that's what we do. We bring up points of constitutional, some of those cases that you saw. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. The Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression. That's what I was saying. We agree with that. It's expressed by Supreme Court in 1972. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. Okay? The Bill of Rights was adopted to keep the precincts of belief and expression. We can expand on that, but I don't think it's necessary. So, as if to add insult to injury, agents scoffed at my constitutional safeguards. They themselves, though, used general constitutional references for all tax years. And this is an exhibit. It's a relative exhibit as a supposedly responsive to what we said, where they say, well, for all tax years, you have no excuse. For everything from now and forever, the Constitution allows us to do so. Allows us to do so. And that's a separate, it's a few pages exhibit. We wouldn't have time to go through it at this point. I suspect such maneuvers are a sneaky attempt to supposedly legitimize agents' trespass on my rights and to minimize or avoid being held accountable for misuse and abuse of their official immunity. But is it? Well, the doctrine of sovereign immunity raised by defendants is inapplicable. This is what Bill was saying. Since plaintiffs contend that the defendants' actions were beyond the scope of their authority, or they were acting unconstitutionally.
Yeah.
Wow. I can use that. That's Supreme Court right there.
Yeah.
Dugan v. Rank. Reliance upon Supreme Court cases is always welcome. Nobody's going to scoff about it. Just like nobody's going to admit, you go in front of the judge if you ask the question, well, judge, is the Constitution the law of the land? Is he going to say no? Okay, well, has slavery been abolished? Who's going to say no? Right, so we base our approach on that. Constitution is, applies to them. Slavery has been abolished. All these fundamental rights are being observed by all these courts. Where do you come from with your liability or jurisdiction? Individuals have no duty to the state, right? We read that earlier. And all these are supportive of the same statements. Okay, so we learned about official or government immunity. If they're acting unconstitutionally, obviously they don't have any immunity. So that's why we're asking these questions at the constitutional level. They don't want to go there. That's why they scoff at it. Well, we're not going to address constitutional issues. Well, of course you don't want it, because it will hold your feet to the fire. F. This is the last of the what you're doing to step seriously on my toes. And agents fail to disclose whether they presume that the W-4 withholding agreement for the Social Security contributions creates any obligations to pay individual or personal income taxes. Don't we all want to know that?
Yeah, sure.
Wouldn't we like to know that? Okay. Now, let's see, what is Social Security? Out of the Supreme Court's mouth, Social Security is not insurance at all, but merely welfare. Heldering v. Davis.
Wow.
Does that mean we're donating without any expectations from ever getting anything back?
Well,
we just read earlier that is one of the benefits, and as a benefit is non-contractual. So if it's not a contract, what does that imply? And we're getting there in a minute. So does the Social Security on a W-4 withholding agreement, maybe they'll come back and then maybe they'll say, you know, you don't need to sign a W-4 to participate in the Social Security. We don't know. We don't want to assume. However, we notice the 26th Code of Federal Regulations, Section 301-6109-1-D3, instructs agents that Social Security, these are IRS agents, but agents, that Social Security numbers are not to be used as taxpayer identification numbers. You want me to flash that again? All right. Also, railroad benefits like Social Security benefits are not contractual and may be altered or even eliminated at any time. We read that earlier. United States Railroad Retirement Board v. Fritz, Supreme Court, 1980. Who am I to disagree? I love it. According to the equal protections of the law, if the benefit is not contractual, then the payment is not contractual, is it? And we have references to that, which for lack of time, we didn't go into it, but you can look up 14th Amendment, Section 1, and Title 42 USC, which we don't, I think that's not a positive law, but still look it up because it's useful, Section 1981.
Mark, a little clarification.
Sure.
It says, the payment is not taxable. Is that the payment?
No, if the benefit is not contractual, then the payment is not contractual.
Does that mean the payment of the Social Security benefit?
Yes, we're talking
then would not be taxable, or the payment of the taxes
okay.
on that benefit?
All right. Contribution to the Social Security cannot be contractual.
Okay.
You can withdraw, basically. Yes.
Well, doesn't Social Security, your payment to Social Security just actually go into the big general fund? It doesn't go into any specific fund?
Well, rather than assuming, let's see what they tell us. They tell us it's not an insurance. It's welfare. And they're saying it's not contractual. So trust us, we'll do good for you later on. That's what I get from that. Anybody has a better idea about any specialist on Social Security here? Well, I don't know anything about Social Security. I want to find out. If the question was... Ask him the question, your question. That's his question. I have other questions. Somebody walked away. Sorry about this, folks.
The question was, does Social Security payment go into a general tax fund and not to a specific Social Security fund?
Fred wants to answer.
Goes into the general fund. You're only entitled to a benefit if Congress legislates for it in that particular year. If they don't, SOL. Now, there is something which you have to find out, or you should know, concerning the special income tax on individuals. And this flows out of the Davis versus Boston and Davis versus Electric cases. And if you read those cases from the district court up to the appeals court said that the whole scheme of Social Security was unconstitutional. Helvering then took it up the Supreme Court on cert, but the issue before the Supreme Court was only the excise tax on employers and the special income tax on individuals was never brought before the Supreme Court is an issue. They never ruled on it, and they never overturned the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which then said that at least the income tax on individuals is unconstitutional. That has never been overridden. And that should be readdressed.
Okay.
That's right out of the Helvering, or the Davis versus Boston, Davis versus Electric cases.
Good. We'll address that and possibly add it to this. Thank you. Further. agent's conclusive presumptions were annulled by the contrary evidence provided in my sworn affidavits, so-and-so, exhibits, exhibits. So the conclusive presumptions, a conclusive presumption may be defeated where its application would impair a party's constitutionally protected liberty or property interests. Supreme Court. Both decisions, 1973, 1974, one referencing the other. A determination may only be made after consideration of all relevant facts, statutes, and applicable regulations, and that is covered by about 12 or 14 cases right there. The determination factor, okay? So they have to, they don't have, again, judicial review power. They don't have, administrative agencies have limited power. They can't just arbitrarily go out there and say, you're a taxpayer, you have a liability, you have a general liability, everybody who works has a liability or whatever. And we shall address that later on. This is G. We chose to address those issues of income in the IRS portion because this is a transition from the FDB into the IRS. And the beginning of this notice and demand can be adapted to the IRS by replacing FDB. A, B, C, D, through right before G, can be adapted to IRS by replacing FDB with your particular situation of whatever correspondence you had back and forth with them. And G, only the second portion becomes relevant to IRS. G says the FDB disclosure officer confirmed, and this is, I have to pause here on this one, in order to arrive at the disclosure officer, you need to go through the 1, 2, 3 punches because the disclosure officers don't come on the first communication. They don't get bothered. Like I said, they respond 6 months later. And they only respond when you ask questions that are FOIA in character, so to speak. So instead of writing to FOIA, you're writing to the officer, to the FDB agent. And there is a provision where they say that you should contact the agent rather than, I don't exactly remember what it is, it's in one of our letters to them. But there's a provision there where it's okay for you to contact the agent. So we contact the agent with these questions, and he does not necessarily want to tangle those issues. So he puts them in that special basket, and eventually a few months later somebody picks it up, and they say, this is in response to your correspondence we received on such and such date. So, and they send you a copy of it. So this, they received it 5 or 6 months later, and they respond within the 15 days from when they received it. Get it? So they're within the 15 days that you gave them to respond. Nice. Nice job. Yes?
Are you going to include step 1, 2, and 3, just a step 4 of the administrative process?
We don't know exactly how we're going to work this out. What I was hoping that we can achieve is all of us get together for workshops without cameras, because you're going to have your particular situation you want to talk about. I'm going to have my particular situation, and I know of other people that welcome this open arms, and they're all hot for when we're going to do that. The hard part was getting Bill to want to participate, those kind of things. So that when it's done, we have something to bounce off of, because he doesn't want to get involved with cases, which is understandable. We're not attorneys or anything. We're sharers of information, and we make some sense of it. If anybody disagrees, you're welcome to state your comments and objections, like Fred does.
So it won't be on the website?
This will be on the website.
This will be on the website.
There are people that can take this and fly with it. There are people very experienced that can do this.
Steps before that,
where we involved exhibits, these are exhibits in actual cases right now, and would probably not be a good idea for us to put it on the website. But you can still benefit from it if we collectively organize under forums, workshops, and bring your own show and tell. So when we address a special issue, you see, oh, that's me, you know, I can do that. And you write your own document in a classroom environment, so to speak.
Mark, have you addressed in the transition from FTB to IRS, If you go to the California Resident Income Tax booklet, it says before you can form or file a Form 540, you have to file a 1040. They yes. will not accept your 540 unless you file a 1040. So they're saying that the 1040 controls and that they're under their 540 then falls under the umbrella of the 1040. Now, this gets to Section 6017 of the Revenue and Taxation Code, which is defined as in this state or in the state. And that is a direct reference to Constitution Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, which deals with the federal zone, which is irrevocably deeded to the United States for forts, dockyards, armories, and other needful government buildings. And if you're not in that federal zone, then you're not subject to that jurisdiction, plain and simple.
You just witnessed a small sample, or yes, of what we put in previous correspondence. He's addressing a specific item. This is more of a general. It's a refreshing of what we said about them, and we don't need to go through those details. We addressed that in letter three. Yeah, in exhibit three, in the third notice and demand. So we go through all those detailed, their administrative, what they are supposed to go by, and those are highly detailed, and there are a lot of people that can help you with that, that already know all those technicalities. We don't start from the premise that we belong there, but we want to make them aware that not only are they doing unconstitutional things and they're trespassing against our rights, they appear to violate their own codes. They appear to violate their own procedures. Okay? So that's why where what Fred was saying is useful, and we do address those in the other notice and demands specifically. This is more of a general and is like a last kind of warning beyond which you'll understand. Once we read this, you'll understand what this is all about. So let's just keep going. Yes, well, I'm sorry. Yes, you had a question.
When will that be on the website?
Tonight. This will be available tonight. Yes. We just, like I said, took all this time to get it done. So G is the last point of the itemized paragraphs that address the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and this is the seventh punch. They are more or less parallel. So let's say A and B would be part of letter 1. C, D would be part of notice and demand 2, more or less, right? Don't take that ad literam, but close enough. So G is the, only appears in this final one. G is the FDB disclosure officer confirmed. And that's why, because you're not going to get that in after you write notice 1, notice 2, notice 3. You're not going to get the disclosure officer to interact with you. But when they interact with you, unless you do and you're lucky and then you bypass one step, then you have some confirmation from them without going to their books. Because they say don't rely on their books, don't rely on their manuals. Those are not to be cited in cases. Okay, so what can we use? Well, something that they send back. Good. Now, that's an exhibit. And it says that agents are, in fact, acting under a claim for federal income taxes. We have one exhibit that specifically says, based on whatever received from you, it appears that you're doing this or this. Or, as it appears in your return, you're attempting to interfere with the collection of administration of federal income taxes, which brings us back to the center of that paragraph on page 3, I believe, where I made you circle that big circle about the federal income taxes. Remember? They claim that. On page 3, I think it is. Page 3. Center of the page. Page 3 in the middle,
okay.
It's highlighted, and it has a big circle around it. If you okay. So you see that matches that. They're identifying there again federal income taxes. So now that document matches this disclosure officer. He's the higher hierarchy in their system there because he's the one that this document ends up that is not being responded by the first agent. And here we said federal and income taxes. Now we jumped here by this document. We jump from what Fred was addressing earlier in the, that we put in Exhibit Notice and Demand 3. We jump to their acknowledgement of federal income taxes. And here we address it for the first time. For federal tax purposes, federal regulations govern, which now supports what we were saying at the state level. Regulations, they said regulations are predominant and everything is supported by regulations. Well, here it is now for the federal. For federal regulations, federal rules govern. Okay? And income. Now we are addressing, now we know we're talking about income as described in the federal IRS or whatever book, Internal Revenue Code. And I have a few things here. All right. So here's what we found. We must reject in this case, as we have rejected in cases arising under the corporation excise tax. Remember we talked about it's an excise tax? But they're talking about income. So they're reconfirming. We're talking about corporation excise tax. And Hayes, collector, whatever, cases, decided May 20, 1918, close to 1916, close to 1913, so they knew what they were talking about. The broad contention submitted in behalf of the government that all receipts, everything that comes in, are income within the proper definition of the term gross income, and that the entire proceeds of a conversion of capital assets in whatever form, under whatever circumstances, should be treated as gross income. So obviously not everything falls under gross income. What did we circle there? What is on the first page? No, the first page. I know this almost by heart. Okay. This is yours. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what did we circle there?
Page one. General provisions. What did they say? What did we circle there? Income? Gross income. All right. Well, it says right here. Certainly the term income has no broader meaning in the 1913 Act than in that of 1909. Well, what is 1909? Corporation Excise Tax Act of 1909. Yes, sir.
In using the word corporation, are we talking about your Nevada, Delaware corporation? Are we talking about federally chartered corporations?
We ask about that. Yes, we carefully ask those questions in the other notices and demands, and we don't get answers. All right, so rather than assuming and presuming, we're going to stay outside that door. We don't want to swing into their jurisdiction. We just want to know, why are they swinging at us? That's our position. But by the time we start arguing their definitions, their little nooks and crannies, we're playing in their sandbox, and guess what? They can shift this cat poop from here to that cat poop from there, and then we don't know where it's hidden. We have to scrape for it. We don't want to do that, right? We're out here. Look, I don't want to step in that sandbox. It stinks. Certainly the term income has no broader meaning in the 1913, I'm reading this clearly, than that. And one identifies a corporation excise tax, which means it's the same. We're back to the same meaning, which was stated by another case, right? Remember that. I don't expect you to remember, but maybe you will. Income within the meaning of the 16th Amendment and the Revenue Act means gain. And in such connection, gain means profit. Okay. Now, we didn't have time last night, but we looked up the term profit. Specifically in Ballantyne's, right? Do you remember what it was?
Bouvier's.
Bouvier's. Not Ballantyne's. I'm sorry. Bouvier's. 1879 Bouvier's. And profit was something above and beyond labor, basically. That was the conclusion. Something, my own explanation of profit, it's a word I don't really necessarily like, is above and beyond what is worth.
What
is worth? That's what profit, above and beyond what is worth. It's a transaction. I mean, if I could have gotten it cheaper, you're charging me something that obviously is not worth, because I could have gotten it for the same price you got it. But the legal definition means gain and profit. And this is where they say, well, you worked, right? That's what they say. You worked, you made some money, and that which you acquired is profit. Because look, you live better now. You bought your car with it. In that equation, though, there's something that they totally discard. And it's my contention. Now, if you agree, fine. If not, but this is where I start from. That means that whatever effort I put and the time is zero. If everything, if let's say, yeah, I spend 5 hours and I get $100 at the end, my time is nothing, worth nothing, because that $100 is taxable income. I find no logic in that. It can't be. That cannot be profit. That cannot be company. Yes. Yes, we're going to have to change in 5 minutes. So let's go through this real quick. And income within the meaning of 16th Amendment of the Revenue Act, gain, okay, such gain. There's a clear distinction. They support what I think. There's a clear distinction between profit and wages or compensation for labor. They seem to agree with me, don't they? I like these guys. Compensation for labor cannot be regarded as profit within the meaning of the law. 1955. It is to be noted that by the language of the Act, it is not salaries, wages, or compensation for personal services that are to be included in gross income. Oops. 1930. Okay. And Edwards, 1921. Whatever may constitute income, therefore, must have the essential feature of gain, which we learned means profit, right? This was true when the 16th Amendment became effective. That's what IRS says. 16th Amendment gives us the power. It was true at the time of Eisner v. McComber. That's one of the cases that they don't want to talk about, and they decline saying that it has any value. And it was true under Section 22 of the Internal Revenue Code of 1938. And it is likewise true under Section 61A of the IRS Code of 1954. Look up your first page, General Provisions, coming under what? 61A, IRC, Internal Revenue Code of 1954. And that's the same code, 1954, we're going to address later. And remember that year, 1954. If there is not a gain, there is not income. Congress has taxed income and not compensation. That's interesting. Thank you for letting us know. Now, we're making them aware of all this, right? Of where we're starting from. So, because they say, oh, frivolous positions and whatever. All right. So, I guess all these court decisions are frivolous.
Yep.
All right. The officer's disclosure resonates with the provisions for taxation of federal income as promulgated in Buck Act and the ACTA jurisdictional agreement between federal and state agencies. Exhibit 200 pages. Okay? That's what exhibit hides. And jurisdictional. It is no longer open to question that the government, the general government, possesses no inherent power in respect of the internal affairs of the states, and emphatically not with regard to legislation. So therefore, obviously, if it's a federal income tax, it would have no reach within the states. That's what they're claiming it's under. I rest my case. The separation of powers doctrine, which Bill addressed earlier, says it's separation of powers doctrine. I have to look that up. It's on a separate file. Okay. Requires such an agreement before taxing the federal income of trades, businesses, or occupations on federal territory within a state of the union. Such agreements, however, may not trump constitutional canons. And we're going to pause here because I think they need a tape change, correct?
We need to cut for lunch.
Cut for lunch, okay. Cut for lunch at the constitutional canons.
One last question. This is obviously a labor of love that you guys have gone through.
Why, thank you very much.
What impact is... Are they going to be sitting up there in Sacramento reading this?
And we're going to talk about that.
Good.
Yes, thank you.
Well, like Billy, I just said, yeah, try and get it from us now. That's the way they handle it.
Break for lunch?
Well,